Welcome to the Business and Leadership Channel. My name is Michelle Boulay, and I'm so honored to be a sponsor here at this amazing conference because it's my passion to help you connect to your own inner leader and let that transform the businesses and relationships you create. I'm a life coach and healer and an internationally recognized award-winning dance artist. And dancing taught me to listen to my own inner voice and let that guide me to my success. A very common thing that happens for business owners, creatives, and leaders is that you're so close to your next goal or breakthrough and then you stop. Doubt kicks in, worry, procrastination, fear, overwhelm, which kill growth in your business and creative process. So I'm giving a talk here on Saturday, October 24th, where you'll learn tools so that you can show up with clarity and belief in yourself and your ideas, consistency to keep showing up, and the embodied and intellectual understanding to move you gracefully through the challenges you'll meet as you grow, as you go for your goals. If you can't make it live, pick up your phone now, go to Instagram or Facebook, find me, follow me, and DM me the word success, and I'll send you the free resource I'll be sharing at my presentation. It's also in the show notes. However, I do recommend you attend live here or at my main stage presentation to get the full scope of what I'll be sharing to help you realize your creative dreams. And now, please enjoy this next presentation.
Welcome, everyone. I would like to present you the great panel we have tonight or today, depending on where you are. So the first person I have is Ashanti Branch. Ashanti works to change how students, especially young men of color, interact with their education and how the schools interact with them. He created the Ever Forward Club in 2004 to provide support for African American and Latino males who were not achieving their potential. The Ever Forward Club was featured in the documentary The Mask You Live In, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in 2015. And Ashanti has been on the top three finalists for the LinkedIn Compassion Award. Welcome, Ashanti.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I got it. I got it back.
Thank you. The next person is Tom Hawking. So Tom is one of the Australia's preeminent advanced facilitator and executive coaches. He's the founder of Tomorrow Architects, and with over 15 years of experience developing the leaders of tomorrow, Tom's signature strength is his ability to create psychologically safe environments of intimate challenge, provoking change with groups and organizations of all sizes through authenticity, honesty, and a unique conversational style of group facilitation. One of Tom's passion projects was the founding of Tomorrow Man, a social enterprise aimed at starting a conversation among men, both young and old, to reinvent masculinity by challenging traditional stereotypes and training emotional muscles. He has been featured on ABC's acclaimed documentary, Man Up. Welcome, Tom.
Rolling with the off mute. Thank you.
We also have Mary Gordon. So Mary is the founder, president of Roots of Empathy, a social entrepreneur, author, educator, and parenting expert. She has an award-winning social enterprise, and what's called Roots of Empathy. She has been recognized by the UN, the WHO, and the Dalai Lama. She has been honored with the Governor General of Canada Award for Innovation and presented with the Order of Canada. Roots of Empathy is an empathy-based program features and usually used in school. So welcome, Mary.
Thank you.
And last but not least, it's Yitzhak Berry. So if you haven't seen his session, same as Ashanti actually, recently on this channel, Yitzhak is a leading shamanic teacher, healer, speaker, community activist, and author of three Amazon bestseller books. He received the Ambassador for Peace Award from the Universal Peace Federation and the UN. 1999, Yitzhak founded a program called The Bridge to Inspire and Motivate High School and College Students, Our Future Leaders, to connect with their inner knowledge and power and to chart a more peaceful and sustainable future. Welcome, Yitzhak.
I'm a real pleasure to be with you all and with this great panel.
Thank you very much.
With you, definitely.
Yeah. So the reason of this panel is, actually I have to say I'm a little bit biased. First of all, because I have children and because I have been Roots of Empathy instructor with Marie Gordon. So it came that I was really interested in working at school and how we can create leaders from early childhood. And yeah, so then we had a really interesting conversation with Tom, with Ashanti and Yitzhak. So I wanted to bring you all together so you can share the work you do or you have done with children or teenagers. So the first question would be, why do you think it's important to bring leadership, empathy, and compassion in children? So as in early years or in teenagehood, who would like to start? I think I have Yitzhak in green, so maybe you would like to start. If you have, like, yeah, if you want, like, because you're four, if you have 2-3 minutes, and then we will go through to each of you.
Well, you know, the main goal of education is to get the best out of each individual, to get the full potential so he can contribute the most for the society. So I think that it can frame the subject. And how do you find what's the most potential for each person? That's our work, is how to find the passion, the curiosity, what motivates one person, what makes it, like, you know, get the bright eyes in a child's eyes. And each child does it in a different way. You know, I have three kids and each one of them has the totally different bright eyes on different issues. But that's what they came here to do. Each one of them has a different life purpose, a different sensitivity, different genes, different past life, different who knows what. So I think that the role of a teacher or parents is to recognize that. But I wanted to also say something that I learned from the ethics tradition in Mexico, that we put a lot of emphasis on leadership, and we work so hard to develop leadership. But what if people don't really need to be leaders? What if their life purpose is to be a follower? What about if they just want to be just simple, peace-loving citizens? Why make them feel guilty for not being a leader? Why push them in our capitalist society to be rich people, to be leaders of society, leaders of our industry, leaders of that, and make them feel guilty? So I think that's a very important question, because in the ethics tradition, they have a formula of society, of role in society. And so there is a 1% of people who are, their role is to be on the top. And then you have the 6%, which is the leaders, the teacher, this is what they do. And then there's a 26% that are doing in a different way. They are the head of organization, the head of families, or all of that. And then you have the big group of 59% that are just what we call simple people. And so I think that we need also maybe to explore the idea that not everybody needs to be a leader, and not every person needs to feel guilty for not pursuing the society vision of manhood, of the warrior, or maybe they're not, and give them room to do that. So I'm welcoming that kind of conversation, because I think that in our Tony Roberts' ideas of leadership, and you know, I worked with him, so I know that, but I worked with their leadership group too. I don't think that every person needs to be that. Maybe you need to listen to your heart and just follow the lead for your heart. It's more important than to be successful. I mean, that's successful, actually.
Thank you, Itzhak. Ashanti, what is your take on that? Oh, Ashanti, there we go.
It's like, thank you for that context. I think one of the things that I saw as a first year teacher, you know, so I started off wanting to be rich, and because I grew up poor, and I thought nothing was better than the opposite of being poor. I thought was being rich. So I was like, give me that. And so I worked hard for that journey. And when I went to engineering, I realized that there was more to it, and that I wanted something a little bit different. But I also knew that I was enjoying the money. And so to leave that, to go to then become a teacher, was a call on my heart. My soul said, you could keep doing this engineering thing for many years until you retire, but it's not bringing energy or liveliness to your soul. And so when I became a teacher, I came to it not for money, not for prestige, but because something in me said, this is what you're supposed to be doing. So when I saw students in my classroom who were smart, but who were doing a bad job at being a student. I mean, I was teaching high school. So I mean, they had 9 years to practice being, even faking being a good student. And I had young men in my class who couldn't even fake it enough to pass this class that was mandatory. Like there's, in California, you must pass algebra in order to graduate high school. You don't pass algebra, you don't graduate. So these 13-year-olds and 14-year-old freshmen were sabotaging their 18-year-old selves, and they didn't even know it. And my goal when I started this program, Ever Forward, was not trying, first of all, I was not trying to start a nonprofit, because I didn't think you could get more nonprofit than teaching. But now that I know you can, I can vouch for that. But what I was trying to do is help some young men who were smart just do the basic necessities so they could do at least this first part. And they all said they wanted to graduate. They all said they wanted to do something in their life. So high school graduation is the first step. And so what I realized was that when I started Ever Forward, I think, and when I started trying to raise money, I realized most people who wanted to support an organization, they want you to say, I'm helping all these kids go to college. And I said, well, that's not what we're trying to do. I'm trying to help them make sure they get out of high school. So how about we start with the first goal for those students who don't even like high school? How do you find success and journey? How do you help a kid say, you know what? I don't want to go to school at all. How can I still be successful? Well, there's not a lot of people, adults, who actually will say, hey, let me help you be successful without doing any education. Most adults in their programming also say, you got to get an education in order to be successful. And so I said, look, we're going to create a program where fun is the primary goal. Like, let's make school fun, and then we'll figure out the other stuff later. And it sounds counterintuitive, because most people are like, we're not giving you money to help kids have fun. They're not supposed to have fun. They're supposed to be learning. It's supposed to be boring in front of sitting in a classroom in rows like they did 100 years ago. So I think that if you imagine industries, what other industry looks like it did 100 years ago and we expect it to work well? I mean, education is, I think, the only one maybe that still rows in the room, the board in the front, the person in the room front has all the knowledge, and you sit there and just suck it up in whatever you can take in. I think that's why education in so many places is failing. So I'll stop there, because I can say more, but I think the context for us was like, how do we give young people a place to come alive? There's a quote that I'll end with, says Howard Thurman said, don't ask what the world needs, ask what makes you come alive and go do that. Because what the world needs is more people who have come alive. And that's what we've been trying to do in Ever Forward, is help young people just find out what makes them come alive. And the success will come at the end of that. Whether you're a leader, whether you're in a process of creating. And so thank you for that question.
Thank you, Ashanti. Mm-hmm. Mari, So what is your take on leadership and young children or teenagers?
Well, I believe basically we change the world child by child. And I think empathy is the ultimate human trait. And I came to Roots of Empathy to start it up because I was working a lot with people who were in prison and people who had been victims of domestic violence and children who were victims of sexual and physical abuse. And what I came to realize nearly three decades ago was that the common denominator in all of the suffering was the absence of empathy. So I figured out, okay, if that's the thing, let's measure up some empathy here. And I also then came to realize working with mothers and babies that it, as you know, you were saying earlier on, Yitzhak, that it's inherent, but it also blooms or fades in the attachment relationship. So no stress on you there, Tom, that you've got a 7-month-old. But this is a very important period of time. So like Ashanti, I started in the school system, but I set up Roots of Empathy because I thought to give every child a chance to succeed. And in Roots of Empathy, just like you, Ashanti, we say, if it isn't fun, it isn't done. Because children learn when their hearts are full and when they're accepted and included, and not through bullying of teachers and not through harshness or anything like that. So anyhow, I really believe that if little children, and they can develop empathy, not in traditional ways, it can't be taught as we would teach algebra. It's caught. And that's why we work with parents and their little babies of 2 months of age, and they come in and they spend, it's a structured program, but it's informal in the fact that they all learn from the baby and the parent and the attachment relationship. And we do this with children starting in kindergarten, and then we do another version, Seeds of Empathy, with 3 to 5-year-olds. And the whole idea is, yes, I believe leadership starts very early, and leadership, and I'd love to get back to Yitzhak's discussion that he wanted to talk about, do we all have to be leaders? I think we need to get down to a different definition of what leadership is, because it's not all standing at the pulpit. But I think that little children's lives are so much more likely to be happy. And I don't mean productive, I mean happy. When you're happy, you are productive. So if you have empathy for yourself, and I simply mean you understand how you feel, and you have the capacity to have empathy for others, to understand how they feel, but to be able to feel with them, that means you can have a friend. That means you can have relationships all your life. That means that you can be a full person, not somebody else's idea, but your own idea of who you are. So I think the idea of empathy and leadership are very closely aligned in some really deep thinking about who the heck are we anyway.
Thank you, Mary. Tom, what is your take on that?
I'm loving this conversation. It's just so awesome to sit back and hear these perspectives. I think, so the work that I started doing was with teenagers, and I was the recipient of that work, which gave me the passion to pass it on along the lines of, you know, what you're talking about there, Mary. I think, you know, teenagers are living heroic lives, you know, they're incredible. But then they're put into these classrooms, as Shanti's saying, and, you know, they're in these ordered rows, and effectively they're told they're not ready for life. You know, they need to be made ready for life. And yet often the teachers that are teaching them have no idea of the true heroism that's going on outside the classroom and the huge questions that they're grappling with day to day, and that they have philosophical thoughts on if they're given the space to speak them. And so going into these, you know, facilitated spaces, I go in humbly, because often I'm talking to a young person that's facing something that I couldn't imagine facing myself. And so I want to know, like, how are you going with that? You know, like, how is that for you going home to that house, or, you know, trying to be the parent for your parents? Like, tell me how you go about that day to day. And watching their peers suddenly realize they're walking amongst heroes, you know, incites empathy. They realize, hang on, now we don't need to be in this system. where we're told that we're waiting for life, and that we need to be taught these things in order to be worthy of life. And so then we're all jostling off with a mask on, and posturing, because we're not actually able to feel validated for the heroic imperfection of the life that we're living, or experiencing an education that is equipping us for the big challenges that we face day to day. And so I think, leadership, my version of leadership, when you walk into a room, you spot a leader immediately, and they're very often not the person with the title. They're the person with a charisma that is emitting from them, that, there's something that they hold internally, and people just gravitate to them. I just want to be around that person. I want to follow that person. And I think that if our education system, as you said, Ashanti, allowed people to come alive and to discover, and I don't even think discover, because working with young people, the veneer is so thin. When you create the right environment, the poetry just flows out of them. It's just below the surface. And so they are alive. It's actually that we take the life out of them, I believe, through the structured ways that we force them to attain, money or success or labels, rather than the gold mine that they're already sitting on, that unfortunately we're not training, our education system to tap into. And so leadership is held off way too long. It's inherent in young people.
Thank you. I'm aware that we're already nearly halfway through, and I can't imagine that. So I would like for people to be able to see a little bit of what you do and what is your work. And why I'm saying that, and why I think it's important, is because as a coach, I can see adults, we pay and we do the best to be seen. And I think most of your work is to be in school in different places to help those children or teenagers to be seen. So how do you do that? Maybe Itzhak, if you want to try.
I started this program to teach in school, but I wasn't really planning to do that. My kids went to the most scientific mathematics school in New York City. It's called Stuyvesant High School. In one of the parents' meeting, the teacher was asking me, "What do you do?" And I said, "Well, I do things." And he says, "Well, what do you do?" I said, "Well, I work with the drum." And he says, "Really? Would you like to come and teach a class?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. I'll ask my son if he wants me to come, because I didn't want him to be ashamed of me." So anyway, I came, and the kids really loved it. And so I started the first year. I did three classes, and the fifth year, so I was doing 48 classes a year in the school, because the kids really, really loved it. And the purpose of that for me was to help them find the answer from within themselves through the use of what we call power animals, or spirit guides, or spirit teachers, or and not to rely on their parents, which are their teenagers. They don't trust their parents, and they don't trust their teachers. So there is an inner voice in them that is so powerful and so knowledgeable that they can, in any time that they are depressed or angry or doesn't know how to deal with issues, they can just close their eyes and go deep into themselves, or feel their heartbeat and do a journey work, what we call journey work, and ask for answers. And I actually collected incredible amount of journeys, because that was their homework, is to write down their visions. And it is a magnificent resource of what, how teenager feels. But I think the issue here was that they found a way for them to deal with their own stress and difficulties. And in a way to find their own inner teacher or inner leader. So we were dancing their animals. We were doing it more in a creative way. So it is a more creative approach. And I wanted to say something about Tom. Well, what Tom was talking about, you can always spot the leader in a class. So I was contracted by the education department to teach in a very challenging school in Long Island, which is mostly combined of mixed population of African Americans and Puerto Ricans, and there was, I did not know much about the complicated issue of that school. But we came there, and me and my assistant, we came there, and we were talking to her about shamanism and about moving and power animals and spirit and all the tools that we are using. And you can see that the room is like half is African Americans and half of them is Puerto Rican. They don't mix. And so we decided to do this journey, but the difficult part for them was even to close their eyes, to trust, to feel that they are safe in sitting in a circle. And what if they close their eyes and somebody opened their eyes and they see them? And so the whole issue of trust was incredible, very important. And we went through that, and then we decided, okay, so we're going to dance the power animals. And we gave them drums and rattles to dance in the school, in the class. And there were like maybe 30, 40 people like that. And and immediately there was this guy who was the leader. He was running around and calling Mother Africa to waken up his power, and everybody was like, wow, and everybody was so excited and happy, and everybody was dancing with him. And I was asking at the end, who is that person? He says, well, he is the gang leader. So, well, that class went home, and they told their parents that, wow, we had such a great experience in school. We were dancing, we were singing. That was the end of it. The parents complained to the school that we do voodoo, that we do horrible, terrible. And so immediately the school wanted us to show films, to show movies. They didn't want the kids to have that experience of, you know, coming, we are coming back to you, Mother Africa, or to dance or to experience. But yes, you can spot that leader. And I would say to you that that leader, that child who has become the gang leader, if we allowed him to be the natural leader of the tribe, he would be a force of good instead of force of strife and anger and division and separation. Because when they were dancing the two groups together. And they were holding hands at the end. And there was a lot of other issues, a lot of sexual tension and gay people that are working, dancing together. So there was such an acceptance in the creativity, and especially because the leader of that group gave them permission to do that, to be themselves. And it was a really beautiful teaching.
Thank you, Itzhak. Ashanti, what do you do?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Itzhak. I appreciate that. And I want to go back to something Tom said when he talked about the students. And I think for me and the work that we do in Ever Forward, it was around creating an opportunity for young people to let themselves be seen, which is kind of what Itzhak talked about. Like, what if it was amazing that you could be yourself and it'd be totally okay? Like, I imagine most adults, if any adults out there who are thinking, like, when do I get to be myself? Or where are all the places that I have to keep changing my, like when I go from this Zoom meeting to this next Zoom meeting, okay, what do I gotta do? I gotta change the background, change my shirt. Like, what are the things I have to do? I created for you a very nice rectangle right here, right? You got this nice rectangle I've created. The other day I had one of my team members take a picture of me. I was on this call and she took a picture and then I was gonna post the picture and I'm like, I didn't want my whole desk in the picture because right here behind this computer is a pile of stuff but you can't see it. And I think the work that we get to do with young people and adults around the world is really helping people see a little bit behind this mask that we have created for ourselves. Our campaign is called the Million Mask Movement. We have a goal of collecting 1 million masks from around the world. We just hit 50,000 last week, which I'm super excited about. And I'm gonna show you an example of a mask. I'm gonna show you two masks. The mask is this representation, and I'm not talking about a personal protection mask that we're wearing. I'm talking about the masks of emotional disconnection that causes us only to let people see what we think they can handle, what we think that they will tolerate. And so I'm gonna show you a mask of a 16-year-old, and I'm gonna do my best so you can see it. And what we have people do is they draw one picture in 6 words. Now, he drew more than 6 words, but you can get the context. And if you look at the words on the front, let me try and read them for you. They're backwards on my screen, but let me see if I can see on that side. So the front of the mask says, I can't see it. It's in reverse on my screen. It says happiness, smiles, and positivity. That's on the front. Those are the things about himself that he gladly lets people see. And on the back, it's a long list. Pain, emotional and physical, hurt, depressed, crying, bipolar, drama, dysfunctional family. This is a 16-year-old. And sometimes we think you got to be an adult to have problems. Because sometimes adults have forgotten what it was like to be a teenager going through just a human experience, right? And so this is a young woman. The words are smaller, but it's the same. You can see. We ask people to submit one picture in 6 words. That's the mask. The front of the mask says confidence, assertive, have things handled. And the back of the mask says scared, unprepared, and lost. And this is a female in California. You know, we've invite people to make masks so they can go to our website anonymously and make a mask. They can share their mask online. I'll put the mask in the chat box. I think somebody from my team is here somewhere, but I'll put the link there so people can go online and make a mask. And what we're saying is that you're not alone. And depending on what we've seen, not only in California, and even in Australia, what we've seen all over the world is that people are clear that I have to put on a certain show. And I know that sometimes that can get exhausting. And there's a book by Mark Brackett called Permission to Feel. And he talks about it, when we don't deal with our emotions or express them, we hide them, we suppress them. He says, they'll pile up like a debt that will eventually come due. Anybody here has ever had a debt come due, you know what can happen. Stuff can get turned off, stuff can get messed up, stuff can get complicated. And what we see around the world, but also what we see in the United States, and I'll just give you one piece of data. 94% of people in jail in the United States, in prison, are men. 94%. So either something's wrong with men, or we taught them things when they were boys. Suck it up, man up, don't show no feelings. You better not cry, don't be a sissy. We tell them things and they become adults. They're trying to so hard prove that they're real men that the behaviors are usually behaviors that get them locked up. And so what we see on so many scales of healthiness is that our men are struggling in so many ways. So our work is started with the young men, but our work with the campaign is everyone. We know that if we can help more people recognize they're not alone, they don't have to deal with a quiet desperation of feeling like no one can see them or hear them. That's what the masks are about. And so we invite everyone to make a mask, go to the website. You don't have to share it, it's anonymous, but if you want to share it, share it with a friend. I think if you resonate with what I said, then you probably recognize a mask that you may have had to wear over the last week, the last month, whatever part of your life you want to talk about. And so that's the work that we're doing. And so, you know, our work started with the young men in high school, and it has grown. And now we're working with folks all over. So thank you for letting me share that. And I hope to hear from you all. I hope to help you make a mask, hope you tell somebody about it. Because I think that in order to build empathy for others, we got to first have empathy for ourselves. If I don't even have permission to myself to feel what I feel, when other people show feelings, I'm like, well, suck it up. What's wrong with you? Because we know that we've practiced, got good at, I'm fine. Everything's good. And that's what I think we need to do. So thank you for letting me express what we're doing in Ever Forward.
Thank you, Ashanti. Mari, what do you do in Roots of Empathy?
Well, in Roots of Empathy, we bring a neighborhood parent and infant into a classroom so that one whole classroom over the school year can learn emotional intelligence by trying to understand what the baby is feeling. And a baby's body is a theater of emotion. They don't have any screens. And it's, you know, just like you were mentioning about being afraid to open their eyes. Kids in school are very nervous of showing who they really are. And one of the things that happens is that, I mean, the program has curriculum for all ages up to high school, and the children absolutely fall in love with the baby and lose their guard. And in finding the humanity in that baby, they become emotionally literate so that they can understand and talk about their own feelings. And I think what I'd like to do, Stephanie, is show that 1 minute, it's 1 minute and a half video, because it's kind of hard to imagine that you would, in this environment where we can't go outside our houses, that you'd bring a tiny baby to school. So let me show you, please, what it looks like. So while you're queuing that up, I'll just tap dance and tell you. I started in Toronto a long time ago to break intergenerational cycles of violence. And it was unfair that, you know, if you weren't parented empathically, if nobody kind of understood how you were feeling and responded in a contingent way, it's hard for that person then to grow up and suddenly understand how other people feel or even honor how they feel themselves. And, you know, you talk about, Ashanti, the prevalence of men in jail. We make a particular effort to make sure that everybody, when we speak in the classroom, and it's completely unguarded speaking, no judgments, because nobody gets praised, and school is full of praise junkies. There's absolutely only experiential questioning, no answers. Are you okay?
Yeah, with the ready?
Okay, I was just filling in.
Okay. Okay, I have it ready. I'll pull it up now.
Thank you.
Babies are 100% accepting and they don't judge. We know that babies love people regardless of how they behave. Their superpower is that they can make you love them. With the help of an instructor, children observe the most powerful relationship in the lifespan. The research calls it the attachment relationship between a parent and a baby. And the children spend time every month with that baby from the time the baby's 2 months old right to the end of school. And they study that baby. They learn about what the baby's feeling. The children fall in love with the baby and they learn a lot about love from the baby and they learn about all their feelings. And then they learn how to have those same feelings for other people. Children are the citizens, the parents, and the leaders of tomorrow. And if we want them to grow up, to be healthy, to be mentally well, to be empathic, we need to start today because they will change the world.
So the program looks a bit sweet, and that film is the little wee ones, but we do work with the bigger ones in grade 8, and they are even more disarming for their insights and for their honesty in sharing with integrity and trust. And it's so, it's shattering sometimes because at the end of each year, we invite the children to make a wish for the baby. And the wish is presented on a wishing tree to the parent, as you would remember, Stephanie. And each child wishes what they would like for that baby when the baby is their age. And of course, what it is a sincere wish for what they themselves could have had, but wished in an altruistic way. So that the homeless children wish that the baby would have a pillow that was their own pillow. The daddyless children wish that the baby would have a daddy. The children with epilepsy wish that the baby would never have epilepsy. But I can tell you, for a vision of tomorrow, the future really is on the breath of those little children, because they carry a power. If we can just give them the tools to have self-empathy and empathy for others, they will be the ones standing up against injustice, because they understand how the other person feels. So I would invite all of you to send your wish for the babies growing up today. What would you wish? And Yvonne, who's behind the scenes here, will send out a way that you could do that, because we are in 14 countries on 4 continents. And I can tell you, the wishes that we hear from children all over the world are similar. So we're not so different as we think we might be. And when we take off all the trappings and we're just being our authentic selves, we're very much alike. So thanks, Stephanie.
Thank you. Tom.
I'm struggling to switch between enjoying what I'm hearing and and actually contributing. I think at essence, we're interested in the human condition. And I think, like Ashanti, it began somewhere, and now we work in various different places. So we've got Tomorrow Man, we've got Tomorrow Woman, and, you know, Tomorrow Architects. But I want to go into Tomorrow Man, because I think it's the easiest example. And to give an example of something that we run in one of the sessions that I think epitomizes what we're trying to do. So with young guys, say we've got a group of 16-year-old guys in a room, we'll walk in, you know, it's a, you know, you spoke about the trust level that teenagers sometimes don't have in the adults around them. We look to break that down and really be uncles and aunties in a way, where they feel that they've got, you know, real trust and exemplify that immediately. So we ask them, you know, what is a guy? Now in Australia, the kind of things that they will say is, you know, he's tough, he's big, you know, he drinks beers, eats meat, sleeps with heaps of chicks, you know, and solves problems with his fists, you know, all this kind of stuff. And we really let him go, like, tell us more. Yeah, what else? What else did he do? What else, you know? And it's a lot of fun. There's a lot of banter in the room. There's a lot of life. There's a lot of life that just kind of explodes out of these guys. So then we go, great, awesome, great. We're going to have a bit of fun for a few hours. So we say, we just need a couple of volunteers. We make sure we get those natural leaders that you know, the kind of, you know, unofficial leaders that are going to cause the most excitement in the room. And we get them up, and then we say, we need another 5 guys, and they come up, and then we give the 5 guys that came up second a little bottle of red nail polish. And we say, your job is to put nail polish on both hands of the original volunteers. And so, you know, you can imagine what's you know, everybody in the class, it's like, and they're putting it on, you know, and we're going, no, don't try and actually put it on properly. Like, you know, like don't go too far. So they're putting on this stuff, and the guys are like, you know, stuff this, like, just, you know, just go along with it for a moment. So they put it on, and then we get the guys that put it on to sit down, and we say, you know, show us your hands, and tell us how it felt. Now, usually they say things that are generally fairly homophobic. So they say, oh, it felt gay, it felt weird, it felt all of these things. And they live up to the stereotype in many ways. The guys that put it on, it felt weird. It felt weird doing something like that. You know, it felt like too intimate, and, you know, like all of that kind of stuff. And then we tell the guys up front, okay, what you've actually volunteered for is to leave that on no matter what happens for 2 weeks. And at that point, it moves from fun and a bit of weirdness to anger, generally. And they go, I won't use the language, but they say if you're generally colorful words, you know, F off, no way, not a chance, mate. No, it's coming off now. We say, okay, so why? Like, tell us about why. And there's a range of answers. Nah, I got footy practice tonight. There's no chance I'm wearing this. I'm going to cop it heaps. Nah, not doing it. My dad's going to clip me when I get home. If I walk in that house wearing this, I'm going to get clipped by my dad. So we go through all those kind of things. And then we say, listen, we're not going to enforce this upon you. But how many people in the room would honestly say it would be difficult? And all the hands go up. Now, why would it be difficult? Because it's not a man's thing to do is where it gets to. Then what we're interested in is where did that rule come from? Who wrote the rule? Like, who wrote the rule? And funnily enough, in Australia, people at the moment, you know, the young guys will say, you know, random stuff. They'll say, oh, the people that wanted to make money, which doesn't make sense because then you lose half your market anyway. Yeah, fashion, you know, and then some people say Donald Trump, so he makes all the rules, you know. But in essence, we've never been in a room where anybody's been able to answer the question. And that's what we get to with the guys. Okay. You know, guys, when they say the stereotype, they say, you know, guys make up their own rules. You know, they don't follow rules. They break them. And yet we show them that they're being very well-behaved boys following rules and they have no idea who actually wrote them. That's the craziest thing. And then we show them where those rules lead. So you go, what are the good things about rules? The good things they always say, you fit in and you know who you are. Okay, well, they're really solid things. What are the downsides? You don't get to be yourself. You never discover who you are. And so you're in a straitjacket. Where that leads, I mean, in Australia, the leading cause of death amongst men 14 to 44 is themselves. It's suicide. Nothing kills more men than themselves. And that what's buried in that stat is that many men would rather die and stop living than defy the idea of themselves as a man. Now, that's really scary, that I would rather, you know, die than kill the idea of myself living up to the stereotype. So the only way out to stay alive is actually to say, I'm vulnerable. I don't have answers. I'm deeply struggling. And that just doesn't line up to what you're supposed to be as a man. So the bulk of the workshop is spent giving them a practice ground to actually emote. So as the workshop goes on, they realize, okay, I'm being rebellious actually by being emotional. If I sit here and I shed my tears and I talk honestly about who I am, that's ironically the most manly thing that I could do. Because I'm walking my own path in that way. I am being rebellious. I am writing my own rules. And I'm not following the rules that some past generation put in place for me. And I think until they have that visceral feeling of the nail polish and realizing I'm held by this, somebody wrote this rule, I wouldn't dare put this on. You know, so there's a part of my life I can't live because a rule has been in place. Until they realize that, they can't look at it objectively. They're just like, oh, that's just the way it is. It's just the way that it is. But once they have the experience of how limiting it is, it's a different story. They're then invested in moving from the character of the story to the author of the story. And I think the biggest thing is how many, you know, we often ask them, you know, when's the last time you sat with your best friend and he cried because he was struggling with life and you just kind of held space for him? And the answer is largely, I don't think that's happened, you know. When's the last time you sat as a class and somebody cried and you just held space for that guy because he's not in a good way and he just needs some, you know, to be held? That's never happened. You know, that's never happened. And so we create that opportunity where they start to tell their stories and generally somebody does become emotional. And generally that, you know, that permission slip is then handed to other guys in the room. And you've got 17-year-old boys sitting in a room talking with emotional depth and weight, and there's tears flowing and other guys are building the muscle fibers to be able to hold that, you know? Because as Ashanti said, part of it is taking the mask down, but a lot of people say, yeah, well, I took the mask down. And the people that were with me, they couldn't handle what they saw. And so I don't want to do that again. And so two things are really important. Yeah, I need to learn how to take the mask down and trust, as Izzat said, to close your eyes, you know, to metaphorically trust. I'm going to allow you, you know, to see a side of me, to hold me. I'm going to risk that, you know, you might tap me on the head when I close my eyes type thing. But the other side is I need to have a good data point that tells me that was worthwhile. Wow. You know, that is something that's worth repeating here in life. And so we need to also teach the boys how to hold space. And often we'll say to them, what was it like sitting in the room when you know, David was crying when he was in there? What was that like for you? And they'll be honest. They'll say, some of them will say, I wanted to run out of the room. Some of them will say, I was inspired. Some of them will say, I wanted to cry. And so I wanted to run out because he was making me want to cry. But largely what it comes down to is I wasn't equipped for that. And that was new for me. And now that I've done it, though, maybe I'll be able to repeat it in one of the most important moments in my life, when it will be a life or death moment for either myself or somebody else. If they can't tell me honestly what's going on, then the risk is that they'll think there's no solution, there's no help, even though it's right on the other side of a very thin veneer of that mask. So we need to be in these rooms. If we expect men or anybody, men or women, if we expect us to change these rules and change those horrific stats, well, where are we providing the environments for them to train the actual muscle fiber to be able to do it? Where are they witnessing it, seeing it exemplified in an aspirational way, in a charismatic way? And where are they getting their hands on the tools to go, oh, I'm actually handling emotion here. The school's letting me sit in emotion. Wow. How novel is that? And it's guided by professionals that are able to handle that emotion really well. And so I'm learning in a great space. Wouldn't it be novel if we taught human beings how to handle emotion in their education? That's what we're trying to do, trying to create those training grounds wherever we possibly can.
So Tom, I just have to add in here, I love your story on the tears. And we only have 9 themes in Roots of Empathy, but they go many classes. So one of the themes is crying. And the stories that come out are incredible because we take the sexism out of it. And the children, they agree we all have the same feelings regardless of our packaging and the expectations, so that you do have children who will cry. And in fact, we were totally blown away with this. One of the little babies in a class in Canada walked on the last day of the class in, when the children were finishing up. And one of the young boys in the class, who was 11, he started to cry. And normally everybody would say, what's wrong with you, etc. He was crying because he realized what a big moment it was for the baby. And what a big moment it was for the mother, that the baby took the first steps on our green blanket. He wasn't sobbing, but he was crying. And the gorgeous thing is, all of the kids in the class said, you're gonna be a great dad. So they thought that he was acting like a daddy instead of a wimp, that the daddy wasn't there, only the mommy was there. So I think it's liberating. I love our talk, by the way. Thank you, Stephanie. I love all these people and I'd love to stay talking to them. But the thing is, if we start early with children, you can liberate them before they have, some of them, before they get to you, Ashanti and Tom, as adults. I just think this conversation is so valuable.
Thank you very much. Can you guess what? We just have 5 minutes left. It would be great to have half an hour more. But can you, I'm going to try to ask a question, if you can answer with just few words, so we can stick to time. What is the gift of your work, or what do you think it's necessary? What is the gift for a child or a teenager to be seen as he is or she is? Itzhak.
I think to know his life purpose.
Thank you.
And to nourish, and in spite of what your expectation of what you want your child to be, is to to nurture that life purpose. And life purpose is not easy. It's an assignment you have that you take into your life, and each person has a different one, and each child in your family have a different one, and in the school too. There are some people who are born to be leaders, and then you want to nurture that. And some people who are more introvert, they have a different role in our society. So it's our the role of educators and teachers parents is to really allow people, children. I don't call them children. I call them people, to fulfill their life purpose or their soul purpose.
Thank you, Itzhak. Ashanti.
I'll answer with a quote. The quote says, "The longest distance that most people travel is the 18 inches between their head and their heart." And our invitation is that people will begin to stay connected to their hearts. And so that's how I'll answer it.
That's Uncle Anangank from an Eskimo Inuit shaman who is a good friend of mine. This is his theme. to start the journey between your heart and your mind.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. Mary.
I think to be your authentic self is to open yourself to others. So the advantage of allowing teenagers to be seen as who they are is that their world can expand to include so many more people, because they will be relaxed and receptive and open to love and open to learning. So that I think their lives will be huge rather than hiding.
Thank you very much. Tom.
I think it's just a similar theme on what everybody said, which is to realize that they are innately valuable. You know, that yes, they've got growth and they will learn in life, but they have value as they are. They are already heroic by being human beings and living in this big world. And that they understand that, so that they feel, okay, you know, I have value. I don't need to earn value, when I'm 18, when I'm 25, I have value. And I think that in that way, it fills the cup and people begin to move away from scarcity and feel that generosity of heart. Oh, okay, I have value, you have value, we have value. I think that only happens when somebody is truly seen and heard as they are.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you, everyone, each of you, for your participation. So for everyone who's watching or who want to watch the replay, you still have 48 hours to watch the replay for free. If you want to see some of the sessions of Tom, will have you tomorrow with the panel around men, Mary tomorrow as well, Itzhak was 2 days ago, am I right? And Ashanti as well. So if you want to watch each session, you can upgrade your package. It's available on the chats. Sarah would put it. Otherwise, you just go on the website and you can upgrade and see the 100th session of the Leadership Channel or the 1,000th session of the whole conference. Thank you, everyone. Again, it has been a pleasure. I wish I had also half an hour more to talk to you, but it has been a great pleasure to talk to you, and hope to see you soon.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Tom, I'll see your presentation tomorrow. You're presenting tomorrow. I'm going to be there.
Awesome.
Thank you, everyone. Good to meet you, Itzhak. Mary, nice to meet you.
Wonderful to meet you all. And thank you so much for your work that you do on behalf of children, because it's so, so important. I'm using everything that I know to put it into my grandchildren.
Mary, I have to say, when I was about 19, I went to this organization to run a workshop, and the young people were so severely disengaged. Like it was chaotic walking into this room. And they're like, "F this, who the F is this guy?" You know, and we managed to kind of get, get their kind of agreement to at least sit in the room to begin the room. And some of them had kids there, you know, some of them were, you know, a 17-year-old girl, and she had her baby there with her. And well, she actually walked in a bit late, and she was sitting out, and she kind of came in. She's like, oh, I got the kid, so I won't come in. And I was, you know, like, why don't you come in? Why don't you bring the kid in? And the only thing that could settle them was I said, would you just sit in the circle with us, with your baby? And I ended up saying that to them, the wish, you know, it was the only thing that would settle them. And it was amazing to see them switch on, to see some of the most disengaged, you know, angry young boys go, this is what I would do for that kid, you know, because the question was, what would you do? And what do you hope for, you know, for them? It's like, oh, well, I'd do anything. But just seeing this, you know, the amazing, yeah, the heart that comes out of them. And there's a guy in Australia, his name's Bernie Shakeshaft. He's got a documentary called Backtrack Boys, which is so worth checking out. He's an amazing guy. But he works with kids that have no hope anymore, according to society. So they can't stay in school. They're in and out of the courts, and their parents can't handle them. And they just send them to Bernie. He lives in Armidale in this outback community. And he uses dogs through a kind of gestalt therapy in a way. And was told by the school, you can't give them dogs. You can't give them dogs. And he came across this litter of dogs. He said, stuff it. And so he literally had these dogs in a sack, and he unfurled them, you know, and he said that watching these boys transform and the beautiful heart and empathy that they gave to these puppies, he's like, that was it. I knew that was it. From then on, this is what we're doing, you know? And so from then on, they've used show jumping dogs with these highly disengaged kids to reignite their hearts. But yeah, as you were talking, I was watching that, you know, that clip with the baby in the middle. You took me straight back there to that room, and me just going, oh my God, I'm terrified. These guys are terrified. I don't know how we're going to get any value out of this. And it was the baby that brought all the value. It just silenced and calmed everybody and brought out the hearts of people who had every reason to be very angry and very guarded.
Well, we consider the babies the teachers. They're called tiny teachers. They wear a shirt that says teacher because they can't walk or talk, but they teach through love. So it's really interesting. You know, there was one very damaged young boy that we worked with, and we don't target the kids. We target a community. So this young fella, his mother had been shot, murdered, in front of his eyes in the home when he was four. So they kept putting him in foster care. He'd been in 10 foster care situations by the time he came to this grade 8 class. And he was 2 years older than the other kids because you keep failing. Every time you move, you lose academic advantage. And he had shaved his head, and this is in the late 90s. Nobody shaved their head. In the late 90s, it was not cool. It was scary. And he left a ponytail at the top. So he was really freaky looking, and the kids were afraid of him. And he was like a full head taller than everybody because he was 2 years older. Anyhow, the one day the mother was saying to the children, you know, I wanted a baby that was very cuddly. And who did I get but Miss Independence, who doesn't want to be cuddled? I put her in the snuggly and she only wants to face out. And the instructor says, yes, they all come from a different basket. You don't get the baby you ordered. Anyhow, the bell went, and these are big kids. They got their backpacks and they're going for lunch. And as they're putting on their backpacks and leaving, the mother said, would anybody like to try on the snuggly, the baby carrier? And our friend put up his hand. And it was very busy in the classroom, so no one was paying attention. Anyhow, so the mother put it on him. And then the roots of empty instructor said, would you like to put the baby in the snuggly? And the poor mother looked horrified. And anyhow, she passed over the baby, and that brilliant baby, having heard what went on, the boy put the baby chest to chest, and the baby molded to him. So the mother was really surprised. And then he went off into the corner and he started, you know, the seasick rock you get into when you got a baby. So he had seen that. He had seen the mother do that. So he has his arms around the snuggly with the baby snuggling in. And he's there about a few minutes. And the mother's eyes never broke glance because she was a little bit nervous, I guess. Anyhow, and all the kids had left the room and was just the teacher and the Roots of Empty instructor and this young fella. He came back over and he took the baby out very gently to give the baby to the mom. And he said, do you think that if no one has ever loved you, you could still be a good father? Mm. And there it was right there. You know, he had, there's your suicide numbers, right? From 14 to 20. Had completely given up on himself, didn't think he was worthy of love, didn't think he could give love. Anyhow, by the end of the year, he thought he could be a good father. And then he got transferred to another group home a month before the class was over. Mm. So, you know, I just feel we can't afford to give up. And I love Ashanti and Tom, the work that you're doing with kids who are, you know, around and all the ideas you're working with, Itzhak. They're all amazing recovery. I'm trying to prevent really early, right? But you can only go so far, right? And people have to ask for us. I don't even advertise. You know, I figure you find us if you want us. Yeah. But I just think that the resonance of all the things you had to say, it's big messages for people, you know, that we have to start shutting up and listening up and opening our space to allow people who don't know how to engage because we've alienated them. Mm. So I really appreciated hearing what you had to say.
Mm. I know we're over time, but I want to just share this and I'll send it to you all. But there's an image one of our former students created. And if you look at the image on the outside of the face, it says, I'm okay on the outside. Mm. But if you look a little closer in between, it's a little harder to see. You make it hard to see on purpose. Across the mouth, it says not. Mm. It says, I'm not okay. And the image is really important in our work because, you know, when you're not doing okay, it's actually hard to talk about. And so in our work, we're trying to give young people, just like you said, Mary, I really love that story. Like they just want to be heard. They want to be seen. They want to know that they're important. And so I'm excited. I hope that we find a way to connect again. And I just thank you all for all the stories you shared and the lives you're changing. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
you, everyone.
Okay. Thank you, bye. Thank you,
Sarah. Now the official president here, we got to get out of here. Bye-bye.
All right.